to the Liquid Assets edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm joined by Anna Szymanski.
Hello.
And by Emily Peck of the Huffington Post.
Hello.
And, oh my God, what a show do we have. We have a show about water. That's coming up later. We're going to talk about a certain large East Coast institution with tens of billions of dollars who's buying up land in California ostensibly for agriculture, but we suspect that really because they're trying to corner the market in water, which seems dastardly. We are going to talk about a different kind of liquid asset, stocks. If you are a shareholder right now in Uber or Lyft or Slack or one of those multi-billion dollar unicorns, you can't really sell your shares very easily. But if they're listed on the stock market, then you can. So that might be happening pretty early on in 2019, we think, perhaps. Are we excited about this, Emily?
Nah.
Meh. So let's start with the huge international geopolitical news of the week. There have been arrests. There have been disappearing diplomats. There has been international intrigue. There has been presidential, what's the word, interference in the Justice Department, not for the first time. We have a story of high diplomatic stakes coming up on Slate Money.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Okay, Anna Szymanski.
Yes.
Who is Sabrina Meng?
So, Meng Wanzhou.
Or Meng Wanzhou, as she is also known.
Yes. She is the CFO and also daughter of the founder of Huawei, the giant Chinese telecom company and the largest provider of telecom equipment in the world.
We have talked about Huawei before on this show, mostly in the context of national security, because various Five Eyes governments like the United States and Australia and New Zealand have essentially banned Huawei from bidding on building out 5G networks and that kind of thing, because they're worried that it will allow the Chinese government to spy on all of us. But that's not actually why she is in the news.
No, although you could argue it is related in the sense that she was arrested in Canada for potential extradition to the United States for violations of sanctions involving Iran. What appears to have happened, or what is being claimed, is that Huawei created this other company called SkyCorp that they were using to try to get around the U.S. sanctions against Iran.
SkyCorp.
Yeah, exactly.
It sounds like something out of Terminator.
It really does.
And yeah, there were people who worked at SkyCorp who literally had the Huawei logo on their business cards. It seems like it was a relatively transparent attempt to get around the U.S. sanctions. And of course, Chinese companies, not just Chinese companies, also Swiss companies and French companies and lots of companies, feel that if they're not American, why should they need to abide by American sanctions on Iran? And so,
because they were using American parts. I mean,
This is a longstanding gripe that basically, if any other country in the world put sanctions on Iran, that doesn't stop most companies from dealing with Iran. But if America puts sanctions on Iran, then the entire world has to stop dealing with Iran.
I mean, if you want the sanctions to be effective, everyone has to play the game. If it's just America doing the sanctions, it's not
right.
Not
but America
great
has
sanction.
The ability to sort of export those sanctions to the rest of the world. And it will criminally prosecute people from anywhere in the world who violate those sanctions. The only problem is it can't extradite people who are charged with sanctions busting, because it's not a crime in Canada, say, to violate these sanctions. So what they did was they came up with this idea that Sabrina Meng had committed fraud, because she had a meeting with HSBC, and in that meeting she showed them a PowerPoint presentation, and in that PowerPoint presentation she said that Skycom and Huawei were two different companies, and the idea is that this was a fraudulent statement and that fraud is an extraditable criminal offense. What do you make of this strategy, Anna?
Well, it's what I do think is interesting is to think of it in light of what's going on with the trade negotiations, because even though the U.S. originally came out and said, well, these are completely separate things, these have nothing to do with each other, I think, A, most people always kind of thought that was a little bit of nonsense, considering the timing. And then when Trump came out and explicitly said, oh, well, basically, I'll use her as a bargaining chip, became very clear that these are somewhat related. And the question does arise. We all know that a lot of companies engage in practices that are in violation of U.S. sanctions. Do we prosecute all of them? Would we have prosecuted?
Do we arrest their senior executives when they're like changing planes in Vancouver?
Exactly. Yeah. And the answer is mostly.
Emily is shaking her head and saying,
no, we don't typically arrest executives even when they're changing planes in Vancouver. So it does seem like this is just, I mean, it's really turned out to be the trade war of Trump's dreams almost. There's so much intrigue to talk about. There's arrest. Just like Felix was saying in the introduction, this is really does seem like
and,
all of a
and
piece.
You
can't
make it
view
up,
it
like,
in, its, in
a
isolation.
A novelist couldn't make up the timing of it.
Right.
The arrest warrant went out on August the 22nd, but she was actually arrested on December the 1st, which was the exact day that Trump and she had their dinner in Buenos Aires, and they shook hands and said, yes, we're going to do a deal. And then literally the minute that the news of this arrest came out, China was furious and took this effectively as a declaration of trade war and immediately retaliated by, as far as we can make out, disappearing a couple of like former Canadian diplomats, and no one knows what's happened to them.
Well,
it's kind of bad.
No, it's quite bad. And I think it's interesting and probably somewhat important that they initially are targeting Canada. And there's also a lot of people who say in China, they're actually trying to kind of tamp down the anti-American rhetoric. And I think that this makes a lot of sense when considering the entire trade war that we're dealing with right now, is that China already is and is going to have to not essentially capitulate, but give in quite a bit more because they are in a much weaker position. And they don't want to really publicize that. They don't want to make it any more evident than it already is that they are in a weaker position and that they are going to have to give into a lot of U.S. demands.
Which brings us to the conclusion, the troubling conclusion, depending on your perspective, that Trump may actually be winning the trade war he started. So, is that accurate?
Well, I mean, we already have a headline, right, which says that the Chinese have agreed to reduce tariffs on American cars to 15%.
Yeah, I mean, I think, though, what's probably a little bit more interesting is what they're doing in terms of the Made in China 2025 and kind of pulling back on the local content requirements and a number of other measures. And I think this is interesting if you think of the short term and long term. Because short term, this almost certainly is going to appear to be a win for Trump. But I think that that's really not looking at what's actually happening long term. Because right now, China is, especially a lot of the businesses that China's really, really trying to grow, are very, very dependent on U.S. parts. What we saw happen with ZTE. And also, there are a lot of issues right now going on in the Chinese economy, which we can get more into. But the point of this is that right now, China is going to at least have to say that they're pulling back. They're going to have to say that they're going to start buying soybeans again and going to reduce these tariffs. However, I think long term, if you look at this, all we're doing is making it far more evident why China should become self-sufficient and they shouldn't be reliant on U.S. products, because they right now that they don't want to have to be in this position again in the future. So I don't think long term this makes a tremendous amount of sense.
What you're saying is interesting to me because it sounds a little bit like the ancient Brazilian policy of import substitution. It's like China is big enough that we can be self-sufficient and we don't need to rely on America. And in this kind of globalized world of global supply chains, no country is that big. The United States is not that big. In the long term, surely we're all going to wind up in this glorious utopia along the lines of what the EU just agreed with Japan, which is, you know, essentially no tariffs between anyone on anything.
And I agree with that in theory. Yes, we hope that that's where eventually everything will lead. This was one of the most disturbing things about the Made in China 2025. It's not just that they want to be strong in these industries. There's no reason any country shouldn't want to be strong in advanced manufacturing. It's that if you really looked at the details, a lot of it was the idea of actually having numerical requirements on local content, saying, like, you know, 70% has to be from Chinese manufacturers, really trying to make it so that China could essentially be self-sufficient as much as you can be. And that was concerning to a lot of other countries.
It's interesting to me because in a way, the China 2025 and this notion that they should become more self-reliant is very, very nationalistic kind of notion. And coming up against the Trump administration, where Trump sort of has the same kind of worldview, very nationalistic, wants America to, you know, be great again, totally rely on its own trade is bad, blah, blah, blah. It's like, that those two countries clashing against each other, both sort of wanting, in a way, a similar kind of thing and realizing in the end, that's just not the way the world works anymore. We're all intertwined. Just give it up.
Well, I mean, and this is what, you know, Obama was trying to do with TPP was this idea of, you know, he was also obviously, like every president, very concerned with a lot of the practices China was engaging in. Mm-hmm. But kind of the idea was like, well, let's really make the world order, like the kind of trade world order more robust. Let's make the rules-based order more robust. And that would be the kind of way to fend this off. It's not because we want every country to just, you know, become their little island, which is essentially impossible and would just impoverish the world, mm-hmm. but that we want to make sure that China isn't benefiting from a system while breaking all the rules.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Emily.
Hi.
Do you ever wish that you worked at the SEC?
Sometimes a little bit.
Because
I drift off to bed, I dream of it.
You dream of it because you know what you get when you work at the SEC? You get to see the IPO filings for these huge companies like Uber and Lyft before anyone else. Because mm-hmm. now, even multi-billion dollar companies like Uber, it used to be like this little thing of just the smaller companies. Now, any company, even a huge company like Uber, can do this thing called a confidential filing, where they basically hand over their entire S1, their entire draft prospectus to the SEC. They don't need to show it to anyone else. And then the SEC will go back and forth and say, yeah, we don't think that metric makes a lot of sense. And then eventually they can make the public filing just a couple weeks before they go public. And they don't need to look like there's a whole chaotic mess with the SEC when, you know, they can do it all in secret. So there's now people in the SEC who are doing this. They're looking over all of the financials of Uber and Lyft and possibly Slack. And they're saying, you know, does this make sense? And then eventually...
They're saying, wow, they lose a lot of money.
And they're saying, wow, they lose a lot of money. And then eventually we, all of us, get to read those filings and say, wow, they lose a lot of money. We should buy shares in these companies.
But eventually...
an opportunity... Yes.
So is this the what Matt Levine would call like the great exodus of unicorns from the enchanted forest? Are we finally reaching that point where the IPOs are going to happen?
It really looks like that. So I think it was last week we heard that both Uber and Lyft had filed their confidential S1s with the SEC. And also we're talking about possible IPOs of Slack, Airbnb, and maybe Postmates, I think, in 2019. So it's
maybe
sort of
even WeWork. You never know.
You never know. So it's like all these sharing economy companies that started popping up after the recession are finally, they're going for it now, as you know, the market maybe is headed for some kind of, who knows what's going to happen, but 2019 looks like it's going to be their coming out party.
And the weird thing is that all of these filings and all of this sort of full steam ahead into stock market listings and this whole talk about 2019 being a banner year for IPOs is happening in the context of what looks on its face to be a really kind of nasty stock market.
Mm-hmm. But I think those things are connected. I mean, I think part of the reason you're trying to, you're having a lot of companies now trying to IPO even a little earlier is because they want to kind of get in before things really start to go bad, before credit really starts to get kind of harder to access. So I think that.
So wait, credit or?
Well, they're connected because the point is that if you're having increased rates and so you're going to have a little bit less credit in the system, you're going to have less money sloshing around the system, you're going to have the ability to get higher returns in safer investments. So you may have less money going into VC firms. It's all connected in terms of the appetite people might have then in two ways. One, for actually like buying on some of these riskier new issuances. And two, actually wanting to fund in the private sector these riskier firms.
So here's my question is, like, does it matter at what valuation these companies go public? If they manage to jump in an IPO early in the year before things really seize up and they get a slightly higher valuation that way on like day one of trading, there's going to be a 6-month lockup for, you know, most of the shareholders. Who benefits from that? Because I don't think anyone, I mean, assuming they don't raise billions of dollars in the actual IPO itself, what's the benefit of going earlier rather than waiting a little bit and just going a bit later, maybe at a slightly lower price?
Well, if you're Lyft, I think it probably makes a little bit more sense because part of IPO, besides the, obviously just like raising capital and increasing liquidity, you're getting a lot of buzz around your company. And Uber doesn't really need more buzz. If anything, they need less name recognition. But, you know, Lyft kind of does. Lyft is like the other brand. And I think it can make sense for them to, if they really do want to get on the higher end of the potential for their share price, to come out early. So people who want exposure to ride hailing and the gig economy might be more apt to take part.
So one of the interesting stories, sort of subplots in this whole story, is this idea that certain companies, including Slack and possibly Airbnb, are talking about doing what Spotify did and talking about doing a direct listing, which is not an IPO, and you just allow people to buy and sell their shares on the stock market, and that will give you a public share price and a bunch of liquidity, but it doesn't give you the initial jolt of cash that you get from the IPO. And one of the reasons why people are saying that might not be a good idea for a company like Lyft is because it's a little bit quieter and therefore you don't get the sort of PR buzz that you get from an IPO.
Right. And I also think if you're looking at the need for cash for some of these companies, because I mean, I think it's interesting if you look at like what happened in the last big tech bubble. I mean, part of the reason Amazon is still around is not only because they IPO'd obviously before the tech bubble crash, but also because they issued these like convertible bonds really soon before the tech bubble crash. So they had a lot of extra cash to sit on.
I believe the issuance of those convertible bonds was more or less the cause of the dot-com crash.
Yes. But so I think if you're looking at these companies that do just burn through cash, you know, they have cash positions, but if things really go south and they have a harder time accessing funding, like they're going to need cash still around.
Is this a sign then that things are going to go south? Like, is this an indicator, all these companies wanting to IPO all at the same time?
The one thing you can say from the perspective of venture capital investors is they really like to IPO at a high valuation and a high multiple of whatever they bought in at. And looking forwards from here over the next 2-3 years, it's unlikely that the valuation that Uber or Lyft or Slack could get if they IPO tomorrow would be substantially lower than the valuation they could get in 2020 or 2021. So if you're going to IPO, you may as well do it now because you don't get paid to wait.
Mm-hmm. And if anything, because you have so many analysts and economists looking at 2020 as being a potential recession, you really do probably want to go into 2019.
And do we think the IPO is going to be good for Uber? Like you said, they don't need the brand recognition anymore, but they do need something to signal, like, they have the new CEO, they have Dara, but they need something to signal, like, we're grown up now, we're for real. And do you think doing an IPO is really going to give people that signal, going to give people the impression that this is a mature company that's no longer like a little frat house, you know,
out there? I think it will. I mean, you do need to be relatively grown up and coherent in order to IPO, a little, certainly more than the, you know, original Uber of Travis mm-hmm. Kalanick. The other thing that the IPO will do is it will reveal that Uber is not just a big global ride-sharing company, but it also, because of various deals it's done over the years, is what my Axios colleague Dan Primack calls like an ETF for ride-hailing globally, because mm-hmm. it has these cross-shareholdings in like Didi Chuxing and mm-hmm. in Russia and Asia and places like that. So even if you don't love what Uber does internally, and even if you don't think that Uber Eats is going to be a multi-billion dollar franchise, and even if you're not really bought into Dara's management, what you can get if Uber IPOs, which you can't get right now, is just some kind of financial exposure to the asset class. And that's, I think, something that public market investors have been waiting for a while.
I also think it's important to think about what it could do for the company in terms of corporate governance and transparency. Mm-hmm. And that's where yes. I really do think the trend we have seen of not as many companies going public is not a good thing, because it tends to create a lot of really, really bad corporate governance behaviors. Mm-hmm. And I know sometimes people think, well, but if you go public, then you're going to be involved. You're only interested in short-term profits. And there's actually very little evidence that that's the case, especially if you're talking about tech companies. If you're an investor, that the whole reason you're going into a tech company is for growth, not for profits immediately. So I think ultimately this could be a very good thing for these companies moving forward.
So I think we should talk about corporate governance a little bit more in Slate Plus, because this idea that public companies are good at corporate governance, I think, is a really interesting one in the light of certain news that came out this week about CBS. So let's talk about CBS in Slate Plus and ask ourselves, is it really true that corporate governance works well at public companies?
Also, Travis Kalanick is the third largest shareholder in Uber still. I had blocked that out, that he's still on the board and will make so much money when they IPO. But it's true.
It's true.
That'll be fair, he did start it. He's a horrible person, but I'm just saying.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Emily.
I'm drinking water right now, Felix. Yes.
Why, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking some water out of a bottle that I purchased, which we can talk about the ethics of that.
Is that the original water that came in the bottle, or is it a refill from it?
It is the original water from the bottle, I think, although sometimes you get scammed, you know, in the city. I've been scammed by bottled water. Speaking of scams. No. So the news that we're about to talk about is this piece that came out in the Wall Street Journal this week about Harvard with its $39 billion endowment is buying up land in California that's wineries, orchards, but really doing it for the water rights underneath.
Just to be clear. We don't actually know that they're just doing it for the water rights.
That's fair.
But on the other hand, it would be a bit weird if they suddenly decided that what they really wanted to be was like a grape wholesaler.
it is a debatable point that maybe at first they were doing it to get into agriculture investing. But since then, it's clear that what makes this land valuable that Harvard's wholly owned subsidiary bought is that it's sitting on relatively
deep aquifers
in a state that is drought plagued. So the Wall Street Journal had a nice map and it showed the pieces of land that Harvard owns sort of green, surrounded by other land that's sort of, you know, brown, yellowing and sad and brown. And it's, I guess, since 2015 has tripled in value because of where it sits on these aquifers.
And because there was this big drought. And obviously the one thing that goes up in value in a drought is water and water rates. And there is this incredibly long and convoluted history of politics and economics around water rates in California, which anyone who's seen Chinatown knows all about. And a lot of the water in the Central Valley, which is where Harvard is buying up the land, there really is this idea that if you buy the land on top of the aquifer, then you own the water rights and you can do what you like with the water. And most countries and jurisdictions don't work that way, but it's the way it works in California. And I know because I went on holiday once with a Californian rice farmer, which is one of the most insanely water-dependent crops you can possibly grow. And they were like, yeah, but we own our own aquifer. You know, it's our water. We can do what we like with it. And
right.
I was like, no, like, this water is precious. And there are these huge cities in California and that you need to look after your people first. And they're like, no, we're going to just, kill our rice every year by covering it in water and allowing it to rot.
I think we're going to see water becoming a bigger and bigger and bigger issue as climate change is now upon us. And the report the federal government put out on Black Friday warned of upcoming scarcity. So I think fights over public and private use of water and aquifers is really going to become a very, very big and important issue. And it's coming at a time when there's also other things going on with regards to contamination. And, you know, there's the Trump administration rolling back some of the Obama protections for clean water. At the same time, there's, you know, private companies buying up water rights. It just seems like we're building towards an inevitable kind of clash over a very basic, some would argue, something that we have a human right to, which is the water on the land we live in.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it's, when you're talking about the history of water rights in the United States, it is kind of interesting. And, you know, up until not that long ago, in a lot of areas, most people really didn't pay for water. You would pay kind of like fees and such, but you wouldn't pay for usage. In the United States, in New York City, I think it wasn't until like the 1970s that we actually started to pay for usage. And then at a certain point, like just nobody was paying their water bill, but no one wanted to ever cut off people from water because mm-hmm. that seems kind of horrible. Now more people pay their water bill. But still, we have a sense in both consumers and in industry, this idea that water is not free because people know you pay for it, but like that it's close to free and it's so plentiful and so abundant and it's never going to run out. And I think, unfortunately, because we've always structured policy to a certain extent around that, we don't have the greatest water use policies. And although mm-hmm. I think most people would recognize that all humans should have the right to enough water to live on. I mean, I think that that's a pretty reasonable idea. That doesn't mean that everyone has the right to as much water as they can possibly use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, and I think that's absolutely key. You need to, and what we've seen most extremely in Cape Town is this idea that we are all in this together and that people are going to need to cut back on their own personal water consumption and in order for everyone to have access to water. What's interesting about California is that it's not a question of individuals watering their lawns, which is the problem, or people washing their cars, or people spending too long in the shower or anything like that. The vast majority of water use in California is in agriculture. Mm-hmm. And so then what you get is this big trade-off. It's like, it's easy on one hand to say, well, people should come first and let the people, you know, use as much water as they like before we start spending it all on almonds, or cows, which are even thirstier. But on the other hand, you know, people need to eat. You need to grow that food somewhere. And the number of areas on the planet which have enough water to be able to grow crops and beef and almonds and soy and everything else in abundance is shrinking. Mm. And at some point, you do need to make that trade-off because although we need water, we need food too.
Yeah, and I think that's why a story like the Harvard story is so, you find it so outrageous, because it's not about agriculture. I mean, those grapes aren't being grown to feed people. These are for wine.
Well, wine is even more important than food.
And you see companies like Nestle getting into trouble. I did a story a few years ago that Nestle was taking water out of public land in California during a drought to make bottled water and then sell it wherever. And you just like instinctively know, like, that's not something you can argue in defense of. And I think things like that happen a lot. Like Michigan, I think, is not Michigan. Yes, Michigan also lets Nestle take water out of the Great Lakes. And it's coming at a time when this Flint still doesn't have clean water, blah, blah, blah. Like, there are just some things that are so objectionable that for some reason are still going on that we need to cut out
One of the things which I'm very aware of is the amazing infrastructure that brings water to New York City. New York City is unique in a bunch of ways. It's kind of, on some level, the only major city in the world, or one of just a tiny handful of major cities in the world, which does not have a water shortage. We have hugely abundant water because we have this massive watershed which goes all the way up through upstate New York and Vermont and places like that where no one lives. And it all just flows down to New York City through this incredible series of aqueducts from the Catskills, which were built in Victorian times. And I spent a bunch of time researching these aqueducts for really boring reasons. And basically, what they managed to do, like 100 and some years ago when they built this aqueduct, it would basically be impossible today. Like, the technology they had and the ability they had to just make these massive pipes bringing water down into New York City, I don't think they could do it now. I genuinely don't think they could do it now. And if they did, it would cost hundreds of billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's kind of amazing what we are relying on and how we've lost certain technology, even as we've gained other technology.
I mean, I think that's what makes the coming water scarcity issues all that more frightening, is because of this sort of decline in the ability to erect public infrastructure and to solve problems on a mass scale. I don't see that happening anymore.
I guess the hope is that if you really did get into a situation where this was necessary, that our advancements in actual technology could actually aid us. I mean, the reason that we can't do it is not because we don't have the technology to do it. It's because of a million other things that make it impossible.
Yeah, I mean, including things like eminent domain.
Right.
Yeah, but I'm very skeptical, actually, that, you know, Elon Musk is going to come along with a magical electric boring machine and solve all of these problems.
I agree with that.
Got to get Elon Musk into the conversation every time.
And by the way, if you haven't read the amazing Charles Duhigg story in Wired about like what it's like to work for Elon Musk over the past year, can highly recommend that.
That's on my list.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company, and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
All Okay, let's have a numbers round. My number is 3, which is the interest rate in percent that a brokerage called Robinhood decided that they were going to pay on checking accounts. They announced this thing on Thursday saying, we are offering free checking accounts and free savings accounts with no fees whatsoever, access to 84,000 ATMs all over the world, and you just put your money in it, and they all pay 3% interest compounding daily.
I'm moving my money right now. Hang on.
A lot of people signed up. Apparently, they got 100,000 people signing up in the first 2 hours. The only problem is it's all kind of vaporware because they didn't check. Okay, the first little asterisk that people noticed was that these checking accounts were not FDIC insured because they're not a bank. And then the second thing they noticed was, like, they said, well, it's okay, you're still insured by the SIPC, the Securities and Investor Protection Corporation, up to $250,000. And then a couple people, like, phoned up the SIPC and said, is this true? Is this insured? And the SIPC is, hell no. And within about 24 hours of the announcement, the whole thing started wonderfully falling apart. But it kind of, this wonderful story of how things work in Silicon Valley. People like announce these things without really thinking them through. Mm-hmm. And then they don't realize like how the world works.
Yeah, it's like MoviePass.
Yeah.
That's scandalous.
Scandalous. Anna.
My number is 90 meters per second. Which is
fast.
It is fast. It's about 200 miles per hour. That this is now the fastest movement by any animal. This record has now been set by the Dracula ant,
Is this just the jaw, or is it how fast it moves?
It's just the jaw. It's just the mandibles. They like have this like snapping movement, like the way you snap your fingers. But it's kind of fascinating. So it's like way faster than the trap jaw ant. So like, and it's, you know, but it. But it creates all of this energy, and then that's what it kind of allows it to like stun predator or stun prey. And I thought it was kind of cool. And they've also thought like studying this can help in terms of developing, you know, engineering technology. And I just thought it was pretty cool.
So if
it's a cool number.
So Emily, when you're trying to get your kids to eat, you just like make like a Dracula.
I'm just, as long as I don't have to encounter it in my basement, whatever, it's fine. Sounds great.
So what's your number?
My number is kind of a bummer. It's $6.7 billion. That is apparently the cost we spend in America on loneliness, according to the sad WSJ feature.
I'm setting up Loneliness Inc.
Loneliness.
Wait, where do we spend $6.7 exactly. billion dollars, and it's, how do I buy shares in it?
It's on the aging baby boomers. Apparently a lot more of them are alone than previous generations. So we wind up spending a lot more money taking care of them. So the $6.7 billion is how much Medicare spends on care for things for people who are socially isolated. So, you know, on like nursing facilities or hospitalization or things like that. And it's the journal's done a lot of good work on the aging population and sort of what's going on with older Americans.
What about the UK? Don't they also have like a department right now?
Yes,
working
the UK has
loneliness?
A department,
like,
of loneliness. Yeah. And people are becoming increasingly more lonely. And I think it's sort of like a quiet health crisis that we don't talk about in that way. We
agreed.
Talk about it in other ways.
And just like side note, because I was just having a conversation with my 94-year-old great aunt who was telling me how she doesn't like to eat in like part of the area because she says all the other people are so depressing. Because so many, it was really sad because she was saying a lot of other people, she was saying like their families don't come to like visit them. And so they said they're just sad all the time. And it was very sad.
There was one lady in the journal story who was like on Christmas, she pretends it's not Christmas because her family doesn't come to see her. Aww. So she like does little chores in the house. Felix just looks horrified by all of this, but it was really sad.
I agree.
I'm horrified.
It's horrifying.
I'm horrified. On which horrifying note... We are going to wrap up this episode of Slate Money. Thank you very much for listening to us. We have a very special episode next week with Adam Fisher. We're going to do all manner of delving into the kind of Silicon Valley shenanigans we were just talking about with respect to Robinhood. Do keep the emails coming. SlateMoney@Slate.com. Many thanks to Max Jacobs for producing this week. If you're a Slate Plus member, we're going to talk a little bit about CVS. And otherwise, we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.